You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello, chaps. How's it going?
Hello. Happy New Year, guys.
Wonderful, isn't it? 2017. It's off to a flyer.
Well, this is our first proper podcast, regular podcast back, I suppose. We did return tentatively last week with some interviews with some young riders looking ahead, perhaps this year, perhaps further down the line. But the racing has started, so we felt it was incumbent upon us to actually start recording the podcast again. Here we are.
Here we are indeed. The World Tour season already underway.
Where are we, Lionel?
Well, we're at the National Theatre, our home venue in very sunny London. And you're in our Berlin studio.
Where Richard has asked me to attend an indoor cycling event this week, which I'm not particularly thrilled about. But anyway, we'll talk about that later.
No, absolutely. Yeah, really excited about that, Daniel. You're going to be covering that for the cycling podcast Femina. Unfortunately, Laura Kenny has had to withdraw, but Katie Archibald will still be there. And there's a bit of women's racing, women's Madison, and obviously the 6 day as well. So really looking forward to seeing you out of your comfort zone there.
Anyway, come on, Napon. Let's crack on.
With Lionel's fake news roundup.
Fake news roundup. Okay, well, most of this is true. The 2017 World Tour season is underway in Adelaide. Very hot weather down under. The opening stage of the Tour Down Under was reduced from 145 kilometres to 118 kilometres because the temperature was well over 40 degrees Celsius. That's over 100 degrees in old money. Caleb Ewan won the opening stage, as he did last year. And as we speak, Richie Porte has taken the burnt orange jersey. They call it okra, which is burnt orange, basically, isn't it? Richie Porte won stage two at Paracombe and looks well set to win overall. And now I've said that, now
it's
I've said
premature.
That will definitely not happen. Somebody else will win. Somebody else will do something in the remainder of the race. Sticking with the Tour Down Under, Kenny Elissonde was drafted in to replace Owain Doull in the Team Sky.
King Kenny.
Sorry, Daniel. I'm trying to remember all the various style guide points this year. King Kenny Elissonde called up to replace Owain Doull, who had appendicitis and had to have an operation. Fortunately for Sky, Elissonde didn't have too far to travel because he'd been training with Chris Froome in Brisbane. It's a very different picture in parts of Europe where team training camps have been disrupted, particularly in Mallorca and Calpe, with rather surprising snow. I know you sometimes get a bit of snow in Mallorca in January, but in Calpe, which is near to Valencia, that's quite unusual. Sky and Trek are a couple of the teams based in those parts of Spain, so they've had to alter their plans.
Sky are in Mallorca, are they not?
Sky are in Mallorca, yeah. I think Trek are in Calpe. Or maybe
no, Trek are in Mallorca as well.
Snowing in Mallorca too. Did you say that? I wasn't listening to it.
Yes, I did, yeah. Well, good. Off to a good start if you've zoned out before the fake news roundup's even completed. It's a metaphor for how we're absorbing news these days, isn't it, really? La Méditerranéenne, the French stage race, which was hanging by a thread, has been cancelled. It had been due to run from February the 8th to the 12th. And that's the same time as the Tour Qatar, which has also disappeared, so there's a bit of a blank week on the calendar now. The Vuelta a España route has been announced. We already knew that it would start in Nîmes in southern France on August the 19th with a team time trial. We'll talk about the Vuelta route in a bit more detail later on in this show, but it's very Vuelta-esque, isn't it? Short stages, lots of summit finishes. My heart did sink a little bit at the prospect of a night in Andorra early in the first week. There's a couple of very big special category summit finishes at Sierra de la Pandera and Sierra Nevada, and the final week's up in the north with the penultimate stage on the Angler route before the finish in Madrid. The Giro d'Italia wildcards have been announced. In Abbardiani, who had a stage win at Sestola with Giulio Ciccone last year. Also in a Gazprom, their rider Alexandra Filiferov won the mountain time trial last year. And Ciro, and indeed everyone, will be delighted that there's a place for Willia Selle Italia and possibly Filippo Pozzato. A bit more surprising is the news that the Polish CC Sprandi team are in instead of Gianni Savio's Androni Giacotelli and Nippo Vini Fantini, who've been left out. They still have Damiano Cunego in their team, And finally, Marine Le Pen of the Front National in France has said that if she's elected, she will ban the Tour de France from holding any stages on foreign soil.
No, that's very good, Lionel, because we did set ourselves a challenge this year in keeping with the times of inserting one piece of fake news in every news roundup. Can you spot which was the fake news there?
Telegraphed it a bit, didn't I, really?
I think the fake news was... Fake news was Lionel's pronunciation of Androni Giocattoli, wasn't it? it's not actually, the thing is, it's not actually fake news, the one about Marine Le Pen. Not really, because the Front National did put out a communique when the Tour de France route was announced back in October, deploring the whole notion of a Tour de France that's
even
outside of French borders.
That's even,
so you're a so the cycling podcast is a terrible organisation. That is fake news.
Sad. This is even more in keeping with the times. So the fake news is real.
The fake news has a grain of truth that's then extrapolated to present a bigger, perhaps less accurate picture.
Mm.
Interesting.
So we were going to do something quite unusual in part one and talk a little bit about cycling. We were going to look maybe at some of this Change of the World Tour in part two and then look at the Vuelta route and the Giro wildcards in part three, talk again about the latest stuff at Team Sky briefly, hopefully. But in part one, the Tour Down Under is going on. I'm sure you're glued to
Rich,
that, Lionel. Yeah, sorry, Daniel.
Before we crack on with that, can I just footnote what we just said about the Tour de France, actually, with some non-fake news, some serious news, something that caught my eye, or rather my ear, in the last week. There was an interesting interview on German radio with Thomas Geisel, who's the mayor of Düsseldorf, and he was asked about clauses in the contract, ASO's contract with Düsseldorf, should any sort of major doping scandal happen in the spring before the Tour de France. He confirmed that there is a clause in the contract which allows Düsseldorf to pull out, and also German television to pull out. So
makes you wonder what would constitute. I mean, what would constitute a major doping scandal?
Well, I think anything involving a major German rider, certainly. But you know, if you think back to sort of the last 10, 15 years, something like scandals that have broken in the past at the Giro. I mean, Operación Puerto, of course, really broke at the Giro in 2006. Perhaps something along those lines. I mean, I don't really expect something like that to happen this year. But quite interesting.
Interesting. I wonder if that's common. I wonder if that's happened with other, you know, foreign Grand Départs, especially. I wonder. I don't know.
Well, Marine Le Pen will be crossing her fingers. That could be an interesting conspiracy theory, couldn't it? Come the Giro in May, when we have a huge doping scandal and Marine Le Pen is seen scuttling around outside the Hotel Ibis in Savona or somewhere.
Well, we can but wait and see. So we were going to talk about cycling. I mean, you've been watching the Tour Down Under, Lionel. It was our ambition to send you there this year. Again, we'll have to put that back a year. But you need to go to the Tour Down Under at some point, having been so dismissive of it in the past.
I've been dismissive of it as an event. It looks a fantastic event. And our very good friend Ellis Bacon's there, isn't he? Because he's moved to Adelaide. And it sounds like everyone who's there is having a wonderful time. And from what I've seen on TV, you know, it looks fine. But it is...
Fine.
But it's...
Come on, Lionel, well, you can do better than that.
It looks fine.
You would love it. It's a great race. Everything about it is fantastic. If you're there and you're in one place, it's easy to cover, easy to have contact with the riders. I'm missing it. You know, I've been a couple of times and I really must go back myself. I love it.
I don't dispute that. And I also don't dispute the fact that already we're seeing Caleb Ewan and his extraordinary Cavendish-esque sprinting style very low over the front end of the bike. That's very impressive. Richie Port started the season with a bang. It's not even the fact that there aren't big names riding it. There's just something.
There are big names.
No, that's what it's not.
Oh,
the fact
sorry.
That there aren't. Yeah, I'm not complaining that there aren't enough big names riding. I'm not complaining that it doesn't look very nice on TV. I don't know. Maybe it's just, I'm biased in the sense that I'm from Northern Europe and seeing the season kick off in sort of quite extreme temperatures. There's just, you know, and then we kind of go back to the cold and the grime and the grit of Belgium, and then, you know, without sort of wanting to get into all of the problems with cycling's calendar. The reason the Tour Down Under takes place in this slot is because when the race was first conceived, the idea of taking the whole peloton to the other side of the world, it was much more logistically possible to do it in what was then very much out of season. Really, if you wanted to make a really good Australian stage race, you'd have it at a different point in the season, and when perhaps the temperatures aren't as extreme, it might not be in their summer, it might be in their spring or autumn, and you could make it into an event that, you know, really has a kind of point in the way the season unfolds.
My issue with it, Lionel, is that it's not enough of a pre-season friendly these days. People take it too seriously. It's a proper race nowadays. I mean, I kind of pine for the days when riders would show up, or some riders would show up, and it would basically, the main purpose of the Tour Down Under from the perspective of a European fan was to see who had basically overdone things. It used to be, over the Christmas period, overeaten mainly. Riders used to turn up with mince pies still falling out of their back pockets, practically. I remember the 2002 race, Ludovic Capel, the then reigning Belgian champion, got sent home. He didn't finish the first stage, and he got sent home in disgrace by AG2R because he was so fat.
I remember that one of the years that I was there as well, meeting Remy De Gregorio, returning to the hotel at 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm not sure why. I think I just couldn't sleep or something. I was having a little walk, but he returned midway through the race, 3 o'clock in the morning, looking a little bit the worse for wear. So I'm not sure all the riders and teams take it seriously, but some of them certainly do. And Richie Port does look incredibly lean. I mean, there are riders like him who, you know, he's a bit of a confidence rider, isn't he? And he will want to start the season as he means to continue. I mean, this will be his path to the Tour will be to try and be in that sort of shape and in that sort of form, really, from now to July, which is risky, I think, in his case particularly. He looks very lean. He looks very, he looked very good on the climb yesterday. And as you say, Lionel, he's probably a favourite to win it now.
Yeah, I think it's not necessarily a criticism of the Tour Down Under or even its time slot. It's the fact that the season, it gives it a kind of a false start, really, because there is all this focus on the Tour Down Under. It looks fantastic. The sun's shining. Everything's great. And then, you know, it really does feel like a step back into the old world when it's 6 weeks' time still, but Paris-Nice, Tirreno-Adriatico, which are much more important preparation races for the classics and the later stage races. I don't know, maybe, you know, at the moment, and we'll talk about the World Tour calendar and what an absolute shambles it is, but perhaps even something like the Tour Down Under slot needs to be looked at, and just so that the race, as you say, Daniel, it's taken seriously, but it's just all a bit too early for, you know, a race of strategic importance.
Yeah, just two things I'd add to that, Lionel. I mean, Richard mentioned a couple of minutes ago that Richie Port was obviously in very good form. I don't think it's the same kind of form that he'll look to take into the Tour de France, but there was an interesting piece written by one of our colleagues, I can't remember whom, at Velo News the other day about the challenges that face the Australian riders in particular, who are very motivated for the Tour Down Under. They've obviously had a summer in which they've been able to train really well, what are the winter months in Europe, and you know, they have to be careful not to burn out at this point in the season, or to burn matches that they will need in the spring, in what is ostensibly, you know, as you say, it's not a terribly important race from the point of view of many of their sponsors. The other thing I would say is that one way in which the Tour Down Under can be a very important race is in providing a certain kind of momentum, whether it be for individuals or teams. And in the past, we've seen some quite significant things happen at the Tour Down Under. I mean, you speak to Bob Stapleton, the former owner of the HTC Columbia team, and he still talks about Andre Greipel's 2008 Tour Down Under, where I think he won four or five stages. He still talks about that as the catalyst for what was the incredible success of that team going forward, that really opened their eyes and gave them momentum that they took through that season and through the following seasons. And then, you know, you look at Alberto Contador coming back in 2005 after his brain aneurysm. His first win after that was on Willunga Hill, I think, in 2005. And then, of course, 2010 was where we first saw Peter Sagan, wasn't it? In a very strong break with Lance Armstrong, and I think Cadel Evans was in it as well. And that certainly sort of set the tone for, well, the rest of that season for Sagan and the rest of his career up till now.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. We're very grateful to them. Also, of course, to Rafa, our headline sponsor. We're doing a few interesting things with Science and Sport this year. There'll be various offers and tickets and so on. We'll announce some of them next week. And they're also offering 20% off to our listeners, a whole 20% off. If you go to the checkout at scienceandsport.com and enter the discount code TCP20, that is the discount code for now. It will change throughout the year, but for the moment, TCP20 will get you 20% off Science and Sport products, which is very tempting indeed. Lionel, I think you had a suggestion.
Well, I don't know. Am I allowed to lobby Science and Sport for some flavour changes? Mm-hmm. I want a Cassoulet recovery drink or a Cassoulet gel.
A Cassoulet gel. Yeah. That sounds delicious.
I mean, I'd probably ride 6 hours a day if I could have half a dozen Cassoulet flavoured gels.
With red wine.
To get me
infused.
A little red wine tablet. Mm. To go in water and red wine energy drink. Lovely. That's my kind of...
That would get you fit again, wouldn't it?
It would, yeah.
Ironically.
We were talking about how riders have prepared for the season, Tour Down Under, what kind of form they're in. I don't know about you, but I'm not optimistic about our performance this season, hearing some of this chat. Rich, you've had a baby. Napalm has come back. He's the same man he was in 2016.
I think he's double the man he was in 2017.
I'm a bigger man, yeah. I'm certainly a bigger man after Christmas.
I'm worried.
Two weeks off the bike. It's been a slow start to the year, certainly.
What about you, Daniel?
Well, I'm still dealing with Brexit, Frexit, you know, all of the upheaval that's come about because of that.
Haven't you heard? It's going to be fine. Anyway.
we're going to get on to talking about the World Tour, but earlier on today, I looked across at Lionel. When he arrived, he looked very exasperated, having been reading all about Brexit.
Lionel always looks exasperated.
He does, yeah, but when I thought he was still reading about Brexit, but actually he was just trying to work out the new World Tour system. It was having exactly the same effect on him. Anyway, we'll get on to that. Let's talk about cycling again.
Yeah.
Yeah? Mm. Lionel, what are you looking forward to this year as the road extends before us?
Well, you know me, you know, in my Eeyore-ish way, not a lot I look forward to, is there, Richard, apart from three square meals a day and, you know, the prospect of the sun shining, although the sun's shining today. I don't like to look too far ahead. I don't like speculation. There's no point considering what the Giro and the Vuelta and the Tour might bring. But I will allow myself to look as far ahead as the Cobble Classics, because Fabian Cancellara has retired. Tom Boonen is in his, it's a final hurrah perhaps for him this spring. I'm really interested to see who the new guard are, who emerges to fill those quite considerable gaps. Because as we know, in particularly Paris-Roubaix and the Tour of Flanders, the big characters are able to really boss those races, aren't they? And we've seen many races that have been defined around how Fabian Cancellara in particular have ridden. And so it will be interesting to see, you know, who steps up and who seizes that opportunity. And obviously everyone's thinking, well, Peter Sagan, will he add some more big races to his list of wins? Everyone expects him to be almost Eddie Merckx-esque and win several editions of everything. But perhaps some other riders will emerge, and it will be, you know, really interesting to see who they are.
It will. Daniel, what are you looking forward to?
I think, as always, Rich, it'd be interesting to see how there are a lot of teams with a new look about them this year and some new teams. It'll be interesting to see how they mesh together. Trek Segafredo will be an interesting one. We spoke a lot last year about Alberto Contador, his entourage, how difficult it can be to integrate that into another system. I think Trek Segafredo will have to deal with that, and they'll have to find a way for the staff that he brings, the kind of dynamic that staff brings. They'll have to combine that with what John Degenkolb brings. He's bringing riders with him as well. Okay, their race programs won't necessarily overlap that much, but I think that's going to be challenging for them. I see other teams who I think have done very well with their recruitment and who look quite impressive, others that I think might struggle this year. I mean, I think you can probably set your calendar by the RC email from Alexander Vinokourov come about April, as far as Astana is concerned, because I don't see a lot of riders in their roster who are going to get a lot of early season wins. We often talk, or we've talked a lot in the past, about the importance. I know people have written in and tweeted in to disprove this theory, but I still believe that it's quite important to get early season wins to impart some sort of momentum on a team season. I think Astana might struggle. Bahrain, Merida, a brand new team, of course. They've signed Vincenzo Nibali. It's really a team built around him. Another team that is, to my mind, looks quite imbalanced, certainly if you consider the classics to be equally as important as major tours and stage races. They really are going to offer next to nothing in the classics, but they are very much targeting the golf race, the races taking place, you know, near to home turf, as it were. So Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Oman is going ahead, isn't it? So they'll be prominent in those races. So I think a lot to conjure with as far as, you know, those personnel changes are concerned.
What about you, Rich?
I'll pick out a couple of things that I'm looking forward to seeing. Lachlan Morton, his second coming at Team Dimension Data, he had a go at the World Tour a few years ago with Garmin, didn't work out for him. He retreated to the US, Australian rider, of course, Lachlan Morton. He's carved a very unusual sort of path for himself, and he's back at, you know, World Tour level with Dimension Data, and it will be, it's probably the best team for him. You know, if you look how a rider like Steve Cummings has thrived there, I'm sure they've got similar ideas with Lachlan Morton to perhaps support him in smaller races and sort of not expect him to be a sort of a climbing domestique or anything like that. Really let him do his own thing. That's the only way you're going to get the best out of him. But very interesting how he gets on. He's obviously hugely talented. Another sort of, not maverick, but a rider who I think a lot of people were surprised to see move, Michael Matthews, going from Orica to Team Sunweb Giant, I think they're called, Sunweb Giant, old Giant Alpecin team. You know, Michael Matthews, an obvious sort of talisman for Orica, Australian team, and surprisingly that he's been sort of ousted there.
I posted something about this on Twitter, Rich, a couple of weeks ago, mm-hmm. and, you know, some people said the same things, replied with similar things, that they thought it was surprising that Orica had got rid of Matthews. But I don't think it's that surprising, really, when you consider
the direction they're going.
No, exactly. And also, you know, I remember conversations with some of the staff there last year, Matt White, the direct sportif in particular, talking about the difficulty that Matthews has in the sense that he's always going up against Sagan. So, you know, particularly for the green jersey, it's going to be very, very difficult for anyone to take the green jersey off Sagan. And what does that leave in terms of the absolute biggest races in the world that Matthews could win? I mean, he can always win the World Championship and he could always win Milan-San Remo, but does that outweigh the sort of exposure a team will get from good performances in a major tour?
No, I totally get that. And I think it reflects well on Orica that they haven't sort of gone down the national route. They've put sort of higher aims above just keeping Matthews because he's an Australian, basically. But, you know, there are questions about Matthews, not temperament, but his personality maybe, and how he will, you know, he sort of lost a bit of a battle with Simon Gerrans and Orica and in the Australian national team. Gerrans seems to be able to impose himself a little bit better on a team, and Matthews maybe needs to do that a bit more. And he's not a young rider anymore. He's 26 now, I think. He's the same age, basically, as Peter Sagan. The time has come for him to win the major races he's capable of winning. He's a bit different to Sagan, isn't he? He can win Milan-San Remo, but he can win Amstel Gold races, actually, I think, his favourite race. So he needs to step up a bit. We know he's got the talent, but he needs to sort of have the personality too to really lead that team. And there's a great opportunity for him there, because they've obviously lost Decken Kolb. They've still got Tom Dumoulin, and I see Dumoulin and Michael Matthews as being the sort of two leaders there, I suppose. And then I'm interested to see what happens at Cannondale with Sepp van Marck, who's a possible contender in those Cobble Classics, Taylor Finney, and Hugh Carthy as well. You know, some interesting signings for them. On the sort of not negative side, but the teams I'm sort of concerned about, Lotto NL Jumbo, they've lost a couple of big riders for them, van Marck being one of them. You know, they've got all their eggs in this sort of Stephen Kruiswijk basket. Dylan Groenewegen as well in the sprints, investing a lot in him, investing a lot of hope in him. But they look quite lightweight, Lotto, NL, Jumbo. Worry about them. Worry as well about Quickstep, because there is a question about their future and whether they will, whether one of the longest running teams in the sport will carry on. They don't have any riders signed beyond this year. It's almost unthinkable that they would cease to exist. But Patrick Lefebvre has hinted at it to you, Lionel. Brian Holm hinted at it to me last year, said he might go into politics instead. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with Quickstep, and I think most people would hope that that team carries on in some shape.
Whoever you are, whatever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world.
Thank you very much to Rafa, who are still sponsoring the Cycling Podcast, and they'll be sponsoring us throughout 2017 as our headline sponsor. They're fantastic partners, I have to say, been really supportive, and we'll be doing other things with them this year, events and so on. So very exciting, and we're very grateful to them. Without their support, we wouldn't be able to do our weekly free-to-air podcasts, as well as our three Grand Tours. We'll be doing Giro and the Tour and the Vuelta daily podcasts again this year.
Publicly committed us to that. Yeah,
well, I think we're committed, aren't we, Lionel, in our own heads already.
We are. You know. We need to start booking some hotels, don't we, really?
Yeah. Well, we can get on with that soon. Yeah, it's a tantalising prospect. But we're looking forward to a big year for the Cycling Podcast again. Last year was big year. This year will be bigger. Bigger and better.
It will.
Like the World Tour.
Well, the World Tour is certainly bigger. Is it better?
No.
That's the big question, isn't it? The World Tour is, it's, to not put too fine a point on it, it's a bit of a shambles, isn't it?
It is what it is.
On the way into London today, I was trying to bring myself right up to date with all of the various changes that have happened. And, I mean, I'm trying to think of how other sports that are still revising the rules for the coming season, a matter of days, really, ahead of the start of that season. It's just, it's not giving any of the organisations involved, the races, all the teams, all the riders, you know, a firm footing on which to make their plans. You know, the point system has been changed at pretty short notice. Races have been added. I'll just run through some of the significant points about the World Tour this year. There are 10 new events now. The Tour of Qatar, of course, is not happening, so it's 10 new events which have been added. But those 10 new events this year, the points, there won't be any points awarded towards the World Tour for those 10 races, and they are the Cadel Evans Great Ocean Road Race, the Abu Dhabi Tour, Omloop Het Nieuwsblad and Dwars Door Vlaanderen in Belgium, Strade Bianche, the Tour of Turkey, the Rund und dem Finanzplatz, which is in Frankfurt on May the 1st, the Tour of California, the London Surrey Classic, and the latest edition in China, the Tour of Guangxi. These races will, they will be optional as well for the World Tour teams to ride. And so as soon as you make it optional and then don't award any points to them, really you begin to question what they're doing in the whole series, particularly as it's ballooned up to over 150 race days. It's unwieldy. They've tinkered with the point system to try and make, I don't know, well, to what end? The UCI say to make every place count. They've extended the points for the top 60 overall in a stage race or the top 60 in a one-day race. I mean, Richard's shaking his head and scratching his head here. It's a shambles. I mean, that's up from the top 20 last season. You know, in terms of grading the races, there's always debate about this, but the Tour de France remains the place where most points are on offer. You can get 1,000 points for winning the Tour, 850 points for winning the Giro or the Vuelta, 500 points for winning a major one-day race like Paris-Roubaix or Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and a Tour stage win is worth 120 points. I mean, we could argue about whether the grading of those points is right or not. The problems with the series are much deeper and more fundamental. They've changed the team's classification as well, so that previously, whereas five riders would score towards the team classification, now every point scored by every rider will count towards the team's tally. And I suppose on a positive point, that does mean that riders who perhaps, you know, if you're the sixth scoring rider in your team, your points don't mean anything. But now every rider sort of has a value towards the World Tour ranking. But the biggest problem is just how much racing there is, and particularly where teams will be required to have a triple programme, and a triple programme isn't just where there's a direct clash between race dates, as there is at the end of July, where San Sebastian Classic, the Ride London Classic are on consecutive days and overlap with the Tour of Poland, but also at the end of April, where there's a Tour of Turkey, the Ardennes Classics and the Tour of Romandy, all very close to one another, and riders will be trying to build up to the Giro. The Tour riders will be trying to maybe wind things down a bit or perhaps have training camps. There's an awful lot of racing, and for some of the smaller teams such as Sunweb and UAE Abu Dhabi, who only have 25 riders, and Orica Scott and Katusha, who have 26, they're going to have basically everybody in action, so there's no real leeway for people to rest or be injured or be ill. Teams are going to be stretched to the max, and as I say, what is the incentive for them to go and do these additional races? The whole thing looks from the outside to be a complete mess. What do you two think?
Was Theresa May in charge of coming up with the the World Tour?
UCI exit. I don't know.
Yeah, champs. I mean, it kind of reminds me of the best metaphor I can come up with is, that point when you're trying to follow a recipe book and you're trying to cook something new and fancy and... you just get to the point where you've kind of got the wrong ingredients or you've done something wrong. It's not looking, it's not tasting the way you want it to taste. And you just start reaching for everything randomly in the kitchen and just chucking in. I mean, if you can imagine Brian Cookson as a dinner party host and sort of inviting everyone in and announcing to the congregation, to all his friends, that he's going to make cassoulet tonight. We'll go with cassoulet line off for you. And then he disappears off into the kitchen and he starts going about his business. He opens a recipe book. He can't quite read it because the food stains all over the recipe book. So he gets something wrong. And then someone shouts in, maybe Christian Prudhomme shouts in from the dining room that he's a vegetarian. And then maybe Jonathan Vauters shouts in that... he once had cassoulet and it was fantastic because they used bay leaves and rosemary, and then Brian Cookson's in the kitchen, he thinks, have I got any bay leaves? Or anyway, this gets worse and worse, it escalates, it gets more and more complicated, and at the end he just peeks around the door, makes sure no one is watching, and he just throws in everything. And that's kind of, feels to me, that's pretty much what these World Tour rules are like. I mean, they're in a very difficult situation, the UCI, where they're having to try to reconcile various different interests, and they've sort of backed themselves into a corner by coming up with the whole concept in the first place, and now they're just trying to sort of paper it over. What is being served up finally is something that doesn't look a whole lot like cassoulet.
Yeah, and on the scoring, I mean, I remember Doug Ryder spoke to us about this for our Friends Special last year, 2020 Vision, about how the team ranking system really didn't favour a team like his, where numerous riders had opportunities to try and win races, and that system of only the top five riders' points counting towards the tally, really handicapped dimension data. So he might be happy with the new system, but, fundamentally, cycling is a team sport, and domestiques shouldn't really be measured by how many points they score in races, because that's kind of not the point, there's a pun intended there. That's not the point. Their job is quite different and quite separate. It isn't to score individual points.
Well, it is when suddenly you're placing a value on 35th place or 45th place.
I mean, this is Alain Zubeldia taken to ridiculous extremes,
really,
isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right, Rich. I mean, if a rider's got to play a team role in a particular one-day race, but then is thinking, maybe I could sneak into that group and get a top 40 place, it's not really the point of the race, is it? That really, at its simplest, when you're trying to explain road racing to people, the idea is to get across the line first, not get across the line in, as high a position as you possibly can.
It's embarrassing, isn't it?
To gain a handful of points that
come
in the grand scheme.
Sprinting for 43rd.
Oh, yeah. But what's the answer? I mean, Daniel's recipe analogy is quite good, because at the end of the day, something has to be put on the table, and it has to be edible.
Is Respinale good, but and you end up with a dog's dinner?
It is a dog's dinner, yeah. And the other thing is, it doesn't matter what they do, in the short term at least, nothing's going to change in terms of the public's perception of what is important in bike racing. The things that are important in bike racing are, you know, the yellow jersey in the Tour de France, stage wins in the Tour de France, the Giro, the Classics, the World Championship rainbow jersey, and so on. Tinkering around the edges and trying to make everybody feel part of the club is really not, you know, it's not achieving anything.
Just changing the subject, because we could go on about this forever and we've got other things to talk about. I'm not a fan of Peter Sagan's rainbow jersey without the continuous rainbow bands. We've seen this before.
Mm.
It's not good.
Where there's a gap down the sides.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it wouldn't look good on me at the moment, would it? As a slightly portly
gentleman. You need long bands to get all the way around.
If I had the rainbow jersey, I'm not sure the bands would reach all the way around, would they?
They wouldn't.
No. They would fracture
down
the
sides. You'll get long enough bands for that. We have been asked a few questions. We've been getting a lot of feedback, actually, on various things, haven't we, over the winter. There is a survey out there. If you're on our mailing list, you'll get an opportunity to do a survey about our output last year. And do please give us your feedback on everything that we've done, from our regular episodes, our Grand Tour episodes, our friends specials. It's really interesting to get your feedback, some really interesting stuff. Constructive criticism is welcomed generally. No, it is. Definitely. We should also mention our friends scheme for 2017. That's now live. There's a bonus episode. That's Lionel, myself, and Francois Tomazo at the Signet Library in Edinburgh. But we'll be releasing 11 friends specials throughout the season. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com. It's £10 to sign up for the year. And you can, in response to requests, pay a little bit more if you want. It's basically a sort of pay what you think it's worth type program, and we're very, very grateful to those of you who have signed up and those of you who've dipped your hands a little bit deeper into your pockets. Thank you, you help us do what we do.
Yeah, pay what you think it's worth, as long as you think it's worth £10 for the year.
You obviously don't pay a fiver.
No.
Or
which
a pound,
works out at 50p. Less than a pound per episode, doesn't it? Well, our first proper Friends of the Podcast special is coming very soon, in maybe 10 days or so. It's kind of behind the scenes with Lotto Soudal, who are the longest serving team in the World Tour and equivalent. They've been around since 1985, and I went to their pre-Christmas training camp in Mallorca, caught up with some of their riders and staff, and we'll tell a little bit of the story about Lotto Soudal.
Question, Lionel, is that true? Are they the longest serving? What about Quantum, which became Super Confex, which became, well, what is now Lotto NL Jumbo? When did they start, Quantum?
It's a good question, but I believe Lotto Soudal, dating back to 1985, is the longest serving.
Look that up.
It had better be, otherwise I've got some re-recording to do.
Oh dear. But we've got others, obviously. We've got a meeting, the three of us, next week, haven't we? We're nailing down the specials for the rest of the year, but we've got some really good ones planned, I think, some really interesting ones. So, as I say, if you want to become a friend of the podcast, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. Anyway, I mentioned some of the feedback that we're getting. A couple of comments about our coverage of the Team Sky story, the ongoing story. Good and bad. Maybe that means we're doing it right, because we've had terrible. Yeah, but okay, but yeah, some people very unhappy with the tone of our coverage, with some of the things we've said. Other people critical that we've perhaps not been hard enough. That perhaps suggests that we got it about right. I don't know. Just trying to see the positive in it.
Well, it's a very complex story, isn't it? And I think you two are the same, but I've certainly felt that if you were to say, what do you actually think about it? What is your opinion? Well, my opinion changes depending on which aspect of the story I'm looking at. On the one hand, the fact that the TUE that Bradley Wiggins had was made public, you know, that's regrettable, because the TUE system exists for a perfectly legitimate reason, and should be anonymous. Or else the TUE system shouldn't exist, and that's a wider debate for sport as a whole to have, not just cycling. But then on the other hand, when you think of Team Sky and Dave Brailsford's founding principles, did applying for a TUE on the eve of Grand Tours fit in with their, I don't want to put words in their mouth, but they're whiter than white, or the way they said they were going to go about things, it didn't really square up with that. And then once the story sort of grew legs and started running, really, didn't it? At the point
The story is the story now.
The story is the story now. The fact that the Department for Culture, Media and Sport were debating the contents of the jiffy bag and finally got Dave Brailsford to explain what had been in that jiffy bag. We talked about this, Daniel, in the Bradley Wiggins special for Friends of the Podcast, Full Circle, which we released just before Christmas, just after that DCMS hearing, and that did change the story in yet another direction. And then since the turn of the year, we've had another couple of small developments. Chris Froome trying to take the moral high ground, really, by saying that he had decided not to have a TUE or not decided not to apply for a TUE during the 2015 Tour de France because he felt it was not morally correct to do so. That wasn't a new line. He had said that before in an interview with David Walsh in November 2015. But it also mustn't be forgotten that Chris Froome has competed whilst having a TUE for medication that would ordinarily be banned. Once at the Tour of Romandy in 2014, I think, and the previous year in 2013, he also had a TUE prior to the Critérium du Dauphiné as a kind of, you know, he had some treatment and was, you know, would have potentially risked testing positive in the Dauphiné had it not been for the TUE. So to sort of take the moral high ground on that, I felt a little bit uncomfortable with.
Well, although, I mean, I think it was more, he was very aware in 2015 about the reaction if news emerged of a TUE, because the story of his TUE at Tour Romandy in 2014 did leak, and that caused him a lot of, well, negative headlines and personal distress, I think, and compromised his preparation for the tour that year. And I think it was as much, he was very aware at that time of how it would play in the public, in the arena of public opinion, had it got out. And, you know, he was no longer confident that it wouldn't get out, I suppose, having been, having had a previous TUE leaked. But the story sort of, and I mean, you know, Froome did a press day in Monaco, then a week later Sky did a media day in Mallorca. Now, teams do media days, but they don't have to. They're not under any kind of obligation to do so. It did strike me as odd that Froome and Sky, or Sky if you assume that they organised his media day in Monaco, that they sort of kept the story bubbling away. You know, they invited journalists to Monaco and to Mallorca, basically just keep writing new versions or slightly different versions of essentially the same story. And it did then morph into a story about the relationship between Froome and Brailsford. And, you know, that might now play out this year. There'll be, you know, a sort of a subplot this year will be the relationship between Froome and Brailsford and how strong that is. I don't think it's particularly strong. I don't think it ever has been. I think it's always been a very professional relationship. And, you know, that could break down.
Yeah, Rich. I mean, I think you can see, you can interpret Froome's comments that day in Monaco through two different filters, if you like. One being the backdrop of Froome's relationship with Brailsford. It's not necessarily always been harmonious. Certainly a couple of years ago, they had a rough patch, I think. And, yeah, maybe that will develop. We'll learn more about that as the months go by. The other interpretation is that, well, I know for a fact that Team Sky are very scared and very worried about parallels with US Postal, and particularly the rhetoric that used to come out of US Postal, the very sort of defensive stance that they used to adopt vis-a-vis any kind of doping allegation, and they don't want to sound like that. And I think, you know, any talk of or any suggestion of witch hunts or the team being victimised has been pretty much banned. I think the riders have been told in uncertain terms they shouldn't be speaking like that. So it might be that Froome was sort of overcompensating in a way and deliberately not trying to defend Brailsford or Wiggins too staunchly. And just on the broader issue, I think it's been really interesting just to watch how differently these stories have been covered throughout Europe. And certainly there's not been an awful lot in the Italian press, the Spanish press, the French press, the Belgian press. And, you know, we've spoken on numerous occasions in the past, or I've mentioned the parallel that I recognised straight away when Sky were launched between them and what happened in Germany with Telekom. I mean, two situations, two scenarios that aren't really comparable because there was wide-scale doping proven on the part of T-Mobile. But what I mean is that with Sky, you had a huge company wanting to make a big splash in a country that was quite naive about professional cycling, didn't really have a great deal of sort of cycling culture, and also in a country which, depending on your viewpoint, the sort of national psyche is either very morally upstanding or very morally sort of prudish, and certainly not really prepared for some of the horrors or some of the behaviours that are really the norm or that have been the norm in professional cycling for years and years. And I think where Team Sky were naive, and perhaps are even still slightly naive, is that, you know, when they launched amid all of these grandiose promises about how they were going to operate and how transparent they were going to be, how clean they were going to be, how they were going to ride solely on bread and water, is that in Britain, in a country which is quite naive about cycling, quite naive about doping, that actually meant, literally, as far as the general public was concerned, that they had to ride on bread and water. It was black or white, one thing or the other. And I think that explains why there has been such outrage and, you know, quite shrill coverage of these stories, I would even suggest.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, Daniel, because I think one of the, without wanting to sort of make light of the fake news aspect to a lot of political coverage and so on, the thing that gets lost, not just in some of the media coverage, but also in the sort of public debate about this, and this is one of the points you've made as well, is that there are differences between running a sophisticated program of you know, EPO abuse and blood transfusions and you know, taking testosterone and all of those, the sort of the drugs that are associated with you know, organized doping, and this kind of I've got to be very careful here, because Team Sky would say that the triamcinolone was not used for performance enhancing reasons, but in the minds of the public, there is no difference, really. They will just think that the TUE was applied for. It was kind of like an official, send it through on the nod, give the permission to use a banned drug, you know, and there's no distinction between using EPO and, you know, applying for triamcinolone within an existing set of rules that are set up for a very good reason. And all of that gets lost. And so when you try and unpick that aspect of the story and say that we're not really comparing apples with apples, these are two different types of behaviour, it's understandable that that gets lost. And I think that's the core of this story, is that Sky, Dave Brailsford, everybody involved didn't realise that basically this story would be conflated with that of a serious, cynical,
of course,
doping regime.
The doping is too complex to be anything other than black or white in the public or the media mind. I've read some amazing stories in supposedly credible places about this, and just some of the assumptions made and some of the conclusions come to quite remarkable. And, you know, again, it's part of this wider fake news thing where things just go unchallenged. We'll end on this, I think, but a point that Francois Thomazeau made in our event at the Signet Library was a really interesting one. We were asked quite a bit about Wiggins and Sky and all the rest of it, and he just said, doping is not a moral issue, it's a legal issue. And that, to me, that brought a bit of clarity. I'm not sure I entirely agree with it, but I've thought about that a lot, actually, over the last few weeks. Is doping a moral issue or a legal issue? And if you say it's purely a legal issue, that it's a very different way of thinking about it, in fact.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science. Whoever you are, whatever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world.
So, cycling. Let's return to some cycling, shall we?
Yeah, this is starting to feel like a sort of training camp episode.
We're not going to go on about Sky every week. That's a promise.
Nah. It's a big story, but it's, you know, we. When I look back at how much we'd covered it in the last
bored.
6-8 weeks of last year,
it's a big old story in the context of cycling silly season, the off season, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, we're going to talk about it again. Of course, it's going to carry on, but we're going to talk about other things as well. And we have, well, some Giro and Vuelta news, I suppose. I mentioned you mentioned, Lionel, earlier, the wild cards announced today for the Giro. Daniel, surprised? There wasn't. I saw your predictions. They weren't entirely accurate.
Well, it was pretty good, I would say, Rich. No?
No, but they weren't entirely accurate either.
This is the problem with predicting things, isn't it? Pointless.
Well, I got Gazprom right. I got Androni wrong. Willia Triestina are in, which you've already mentioned. Actually, you've already given us a complete rundown.
Yeah, he did.
They're Willia Selle Italia now.
I mean, Joe Dombrowski will be pleased. No, Vini Frantini.
Why is that?
Daniel, did you not listen to Dombrowski's audio diary of the Giro last year? It was a friend's special. Come on.
Excellent.
One of our most popular.
No, I'm not a friend of the podcast. I'm more of an enemy from within the podcast.
Unbelievable.
Oh, this is amazing. First full episode of the year, and Daniel drops that clanger.
Dear. Well, I suggest you go back and listen to it, Daniel. I'm sure we can. Well, just pay your tenner, you know, or pay a bit more and become a friend of the podcast.
This could be the end of the podcast.
On a series, not just Joe Dombrowski though, but Max Chiandri said that they were pretty unpopular, Nippo Vini Fantini, because you know, they were attacking at all sorts of odd times and
doing odd sorts of things. Cycle race.
I know, but you know, they've got people who work within cycling have got very, you know, got very sort of restricting and constricted ideas of what is and what isn't fair game, haven't they? And wasn't there a day where they all were attacking
to try and get the mountain jersey,
and they were upsetting
the rhythm. They would chase
down
breaks if you missed them, and then they'd miss the next one.
Yeah. And they came out of the Giro with next to nothing to celebrate anyway.
So they're not there this year.
But Daniel, what's your take on it?
Yeah, well, Nippo Fantini didn't have a particularly good season, Giro aside, so I'm not that surprised. Androni, it's a real body blow for them. It's the second year in a row that they've missed out. Gianni Savio's missed out. And I think that this might even spell the end of the road for that team. I don't really see how they can survive without a second Giro, and you know, Italy losing another team. I tweeted earlier that 20 years ago, so 1997 Giro, there were 16 Italian teams. Next year, or this year in 2017, there are going to be two in the 100th edition of the Giro, so an important edition. And that really signifies the extent to which cycling in Italy, and certainly at that level below the World Tour, is kind of withering on the vine. Teams disappearing, races disappearing, or have been for years, and partly because there aren't enough teams of a reasonable level to take part. And of course, if that's the case, then you're not going to get people coming to watch the races, and sponsors therefore aren't going to be that interested. We talk about protectionism. We've been talking about protectionism in relation to Theresa Mayhem. I mean, May's speech yesterday. But I think in this instance, as far as Italian cycling is concerned, I think they should maybe be given a bit of a leg up by the Giro. And RCS's argument over the last few years has been that they haven't presented good enough projects, is the word that they use. So they're talking about the professional division Italian teams. Not enough of an infrastructure. They didn't have academies. Not enough professionalism. And that may be true, but they simply can't afford those things. You know, partly because they can't guarantee their place in the Giro. So it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation. And I think in this case, it's a sad day, really, for Italian cycling with that prospect of losing another professional division team. And in this instance, Gianni Savio's team, which, okay, Gianni Savio's ethics have come under scrutiny in the past. There have been a lot of positive tests in that team over the years. But it is a team that's been around in professional cycling for a very long time. And he's one of the more colourful characters, certainly, in Italian professional cycling.
Well, Androni, didn't they issue put together a dossier of 100 reasons why they should be given a wild card place in the 100th Giro.
Yeah, they did, Lionel, but they weren't particularly persuasive there at some of their arguments. One of them was...
Could they not just have listed their 100 sponsors?
Well, yeah, that would have been one option. But yeah, one of their arguments, one of their reasons why they should have been selected was that they had a new Instagram account.
Well,
I'm surprised that didn't swing it. Really surprised. Amazing. Well, what more can they do?
But it is telling, though, isn't it, when there isn't even an Italian World Tour team. I know there's a heavy Italian presence in Bahrain Merida, and, yeah, you know, there's still star riders in Vincenzo Nibali and Fabio Aru. But you're right, the malaise in Italian cycling starts a lot higher up the tree than at the kind of wildcard level, doesn't it? And the wildcard teams are counting the cost, really, some of them.
Yeah, and, you know, they're paying the price, really, for years of complacency about doping problems. But also the Italian economy has not been particularly strong, certainly over the last 10 or 15 years. And the teams that would traditionally support these sort of lower-level... Or, sorry, the sponsors that would traditionally support these lower-level Italian teams represent a sort of... a level of Italian industry or a bracket within Italian industry that has very much, well, has suffered a great deal over the last few years. So, you know, you're talking about the building trade, the sort of engines of what is known as the Italian economic miracle in the sort of 50s, 60s, medium-sized manufacturing businesses, they've really suffered in the face of competition from the Far East over the last few years, and they've stopped sponsoring cycling. And at the same time, cycling has sort of lost its foothold, certainly with younger audiences. And these teams have found themselves under more and more pressure, these sort of professional division teams, and even more so because the Italian calendar has lost races, and also because of the World Tour and competition from, you know, places like Bahrain and launching teams, the UAE. Yeah, and the consequently, that level, that division, that kind of group of teams, the professional and continental division teams, is getting smaller and smaller. We might lose another team in Androni next year, and the sort of top of the cycling pyramid... it's a very pointy pyramid and a very sort of sheer drop down to not very much, and we're sort of moving towards that, almost that closed shop system that we talked about with Jonathan Vauters in our 2020 special a few weeks ago, that you know, with 18 teams or however many teams at the very top level and not very much underneath at all.
Yeah, I think you're right, Daniel. I think it's going to happen by default, isn't it? It's not so much that the small races will disappear, meaning that there isn't a kind of a ladder of progression for young riders to move their way up towards the World Tour. There will very much be a big gap between the World Tour and then a sort of amateur level. There won't really be a sort of second division of professional racing that just about exists at the moment. But, you know, that's going to be a slow, possibly painful process, and we're certainly witnessing the beginning of that at the moment.
This was supposed to be an upbeat section.
Sorry, yeah.
Well, hang on, Rich. I was actually also going to point out that the Giro field looks strong, very strong.
It looks incredibly promising, doesn't it? It looks fantastic.
You've got Dumoulin, Kruiswijk, Chavez, Pino, Aru, Zakarin, Landa, Geraint Thomas.
Quintana,
of course.
No, but once again, the Giro is going to be the race that keeps everyone guessing, isn't it? Whereas the Tour, even this far out, it's very hard to look beyond the big two of Chris Froome and Nairo Quintana. And this is me speculating.
Oh my goodness,
this
January.
I mean,
okay, how about the Vuelta? Who's going to win the Vuelta? No, the route for the Vuelta, the main thing that caught your eye, I think, Daniel, was just the length of transfers. But that's more of a concern for us, and that's, you know, our boring travel arrangements. But
well, and the riders, to be fair, Rich. I spoke to a couple this week.
And riders, true.
Yeah, I spoke to a couple this week and asked them whether it would influence their choice of which Grand Tour they would like to do. Mark Cavendish was one of them. He said that it was more of an issue for the guys preparing for the World Championships, that they might decide to pursue different avenues as a result of the 3,000 kilometres of transfers on the Vueltas. That was a fun afternoon working that out.
How about the route then, Daniel? The bits where they'll actually be on their bikes? What do you make of that?
Well, it's fairly typical of Vuelta routes in the last few years. A lot of steep climbs, 9 summit finishes in total. Short stages, the whole route is 200 kilometres shorter than the Giro route, for example. There are some steep climbs, not as many steep climbs, not as many goat tracks. The Spanish always talk about the roads for the cabras, the goats, which they've been very critical of in the Vuelta the last few years. But there are still some really steep ones. The Pandera is very steep. Angliru, Zoret de Cati, which is very steep as well. And then there's a finish at 2,400 meters on the Sierra Nevada. They're not going to the Pico de Veleta, the highest road in mainland Europe. There was talk of that. Javier Guillen, the race organizer, said to me last year at the Vuelta that he wanted to go there, but it was wind was going to be an issue. So they've decided not to try that attempt that this year. Otherwise, it's going to be quite a quiet first week. They start in Nîmes, of course, in France, and the main action is going to be concentrated particularly in the second and especially the third week when we go up north again after a very long transfer, about an 800 kilometre transfer up to Logroño. And the riders are going to face the Angliru again, where, of course, friend of the podcast, King Kenny Elizonde won on the last visit. So overall, I think it's a route that will appeal to a lot of riders. You think about what Chris Froome did in the Vuelta this year, and he's gone to the Vuelta regularly in the last few seasons, but I don't think he will go with the kind of team, or I don't think he'll want to go with the kind of team he took to the Vuelta last year, which sort of disintegrated on that famous stage to Formigal. I think he will really think harder, and the team will think harder about the riders that they want to prepare and take to the Vuelta. And you also think about other riders that did well this year, in 2016, Simon Yates and Esteban Chavez at Orica. I mean, it's going to be really interesting to see how they play their cards in the Grand Tours next year, who they send where.
Really curious to see that. It's going to be. What do you do? You've got these three aces in the pack, I suppose. How do you distribute them? I mean, Simon Yates and Esteban Chavez were such a potent force together, really, in the Vuelta. Adam Yates, of course, had an outstanding tour. Do you put two in the race? Do you give them one each? What do you do? It's an intriguing scenario.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would be sending Chavez to the Giro again. We said last year that we thought Nibali might not win another Grand Tour, and Chavez almost had the measure of him last year. I mentioned the time trialing, almost 70 kilometres of time trialing in the Giro. That obviously is not going to favour him, and I would expect him to lose 3-4 minutes in time trials to Nibali, but I think he can match him in the mountains. And then it becomes a question of who else is going to be there. Can Chavez beat Quintana in the mountains? It didn't look that way at the Vuelta last year, but as I said earlier, I'm really not convinced that Quintana is going to be at the Giro, and I think Chavez is more than a match for every other rider who is going to go to Italy to do the Giro.
So what they'll probably do is put Chavez in the Giro, Chavez in the Vuelta, and the Yates twins in the Tour.
I would think so, Rich, yeah. That would be my plan.
Well, that's Orica's season planned out for them. We should start to wrap things up soon.
No, Rich, I was just going to say about the Vuelta. I mean, it's always so difficult to know, isn't it, who's going to take part. I mean, I tweeted before Christmas that the Vuelta is kind of like that nightclub that you always end up at the end of a boozy night, having promised to all your mates that you weren't going to go there this week. I don't know if you had you must have had a place at university, Rich. We used to have a place. I went to university in London, and we used to go to Hombres, as in Donald Trump's bad hombre. And we used to promise, we used to go out on a Saturday night and we would all promise that we weren't going to end up at Ombres. And yeah, you know, 4 or 5 hours later, a few pints of borderline illegal tasting lager later, there we would be on the dance floor in Ombres, cutting some scandalous shapes.
So that's the Vuelta, basically. So everyone at this point of the season is saying they're not doing the Vuelta, including Mark Cavendish. They'll be charging towards the Vuelta.
And you'd spot Esteban Chavez on the dance floor in his Pedalard de Charme t-shirt.
It's not an inaccurate comparison if you think about sort of Andy Schleck at the Vuelta and various other characters over the years. So anyway, that's the Vuelta covered. What will we preview next week? Il Lombardia.
I think we're doing the 2018 preview in early February.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Thanks very much, Daniel. We'll be back. We'll be back next week. You're off to Abu Dhabi soon, are you not?
No, it's Abu Dhabi is end of February.
Oh, is it? Sorry. Are you sure? Anyway, you're off there some point. But we are getting together in London next week, so we'll see you then. Thank you very much for the moment, Daniel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.